This is Herb Montgomery, Director of Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. Renewed Heart Ministries is a not-for-profit organization that is dedicated to helping people explore and understand the teachings of Jesus. Everything we do here is for free, even our seminars that we do in various venues. So if you'd like to help us keep doing what we do, I'll tell you how you can do that at the end of this podcast. For now, it's our hope that you will just simply enjoy this podcast as our gift to you. This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is Matthew 28, verses 18 and 9, and I'm reading it from Peterson's The Message. Go out and train everyone you meet, far and near, in this way of life. Instruct them in the practice of all that I have, and I'm going to put the word in here, taught you. Now, last week, we talked about one of the worldviews that informed the writers of the gospel, and we learned about the traits of the ancient apocalyptic worldview and how it differs from the modern Christian focus on the end times. This week, let's talk about another worldview, and I believe this worldview influences how we read the gospels too, and that's a worldview called naturalism. So the title this week is Jesus and Naturalism. It's important to understand how the beliefs that we take for granted in our time mirror and how they differ from the worldview of the Jesus of the Gospels and the disciples who wrote about him. So what is naturalism? Let's start there. Naturalism seeks to explain what happens in this world by natural causes, natural laws. And this is instead of, or as opposed to appealing to supernatural explanations. In its purest form, it assumes that this world is a closed system, which means that nothing that isn't already part of this world can be looked at as a cause to explain why something in this world is happening. Not all naturalists are pure naturalists, however. Today, many people in the West would much rather look for a natural cause and cure for conditions like, say, example, a lupus, than assume that a person's lupus is caused by a supernatural demon or that they should see an exorcist. They're not going to go to the doctor for prayer. They're going to the doctor for medicine. Yet many of these same naturalists are also theists, and they still accept the possibility of supernatural intervention. Christian theists specifically still believe in the healing Jesus. So naturalism in its purest form leaves a person with three options when it comes to a divine being. Number one, no God exists, and that's atheism. Number two, God exists but is disconnected from and uninvolved in this world, that's deism. And number three, nature is God, and that's pantheism. The atheist, deist, and the pantheist, these types of naturalists can also be referred to as metaphysical naturalists. They agree that the supernatural does not exist. But there are other types of naturalists, like the theists who seek natural medical explanations for illnesses, these are mere methodological naturalists. They prioritize natural causes, natural effects, and explanations for things that happen on this planet. Scientific research and discovery is possible whether you're a metaphysical naturalist or just a methodological naturalist. Many of my theist friends who are naturalists still maintain a belief in a personal God from whom these natural laws of cause and effect originated. And a recent study, and I'll give a link to this study in the e-site this week, but a recent survey of professional scientists have shown that more than half conduct their research and also believe in a higher power. So more than half of scientists still do research and are theists. So let's talk about the strengths of naturalism for a moment. Number one, the discovery of actual causation. Naturalism began with the ancient Greek philosophers' attempts to explain this world without appealing to the Greek gods. And naturalism, as we know it today made its first significant inroads into Christianity during the 12th century Renaissance, thanks to Christian naturalist philosophers. It then picked up steam in the 16th century, where Christian scientists referred to the study of nature as the study of God's secondary causes. That's what they called them. And Galileo promoted naturalism during this time. This is when he gained his claim to fame. And the approach allowed early scientists to discover some of the basic laws of nature. Another benefit is with these basic laws of nature, if you can discover and predict the causes of things that promote human suffering, then you can discover ways to prevent or to cure human suffering as well. And over the last several centuries, scientific naturalism has significantly lessened human suffering on this planet and increased a quality of life for at least the beneficiaries of those discoveries. Number three, there was a deliverance from superstition. Using a scientific basis, Christian naturalist scientists like Galileo began noticing the observable and measurable forces that have repeatable results on things in the world. They found causes for the things that were happening around them rather than appealing to the existence of devils or angels behind every bush or every event. And this is significant on a religious level. As people began to discover natural reasons for their suffering through science, they lost fear of provoking the anger of the church's God or fear of varying from the teachings and explanations of church officials. The Black Death, for example, was not the result of God's wrath. It was the result of germs, and lightning strikes were not a sign of an angry God. They were the product of observable changes in the atmosphere. And connectedness, too, another strength of naturalism is a sense of connectedness. Naturalists believe that all of the natural world is connected in a network of causes and effects. And this connectedness that we share with one another, it can lead to concern and care for others besides just ourselves or those that are like ourselves. And ultimately, naturalism has empowered human compassion with tangible methods and means to make a difference in the lives of those that are presently hurting. Lastly, responsibility and accountability. Naturalism, I think, has more benefits than what I've listed here, but another one that is meaningful to me is this emphasis on human responsibility for the things that happen on this planet. The worldview of naturalism encourages people to embrace accountability toward each other, towards one another, and not to excuse themselves by blaming supernatural forces. A pastor friend of mine who's deeply concerned with climate change and also lives in the fundamentalist Bible Belt, each time a natural disaster occurs, he's fond of saying, when bad things happen, God gets blamed for things God didn't do, a devil gets blamed for things a devil didn't do, and people continue to not take responsibility for the things that we are setting in motion. Some of the weaknesses of naturalism, the naturalistic worldview, it has some beautiful strengths, but it has a few weaknesses as well. Number one is a dependence on rationalism. Science has no explanation for many of the things that happen on this planet. And although my metaphysical naturalist friends would be quick to say science has no explanation yet, time will tell whether everything on this planet can truly be explained by only appealing to nature without accounting for the supernatural. And we can't yet know. The vote is still out from the evidence and from science. But number two, an addiction to explanations. While we can explain most things, we sometimes have a tendency to have to explain everything. And naturalism can produce an intolerance of mystery. And I do agree that many mysteries need to be solved. And some things become more beautiful as they are explained. But I also believe that some things become less beautiful once their mystery is removed and they become explainable. And life must also not just be explainable, it has to also possess enough beauty and mystery that it's still worth living. And lastly, I want to talk about some of the other critiques of naturalism, of meaninglessness, absence of compassion, and lack of ethics. There are a number of popular Christian critiques of the naturalist worldview, and these are three of them. First, some Christians say that naturalism produces a meaningless existence, and I've found this to be untrue. Instead, life takes on new and different meanings. Secondly, some Christians say that the naturalistic worldview robs humanity of any compassion because it doesn't root service to humans in service to a divine being, a supernatural being, or a god. And I've also found this to be untrue. Human compassion results from our discovery of our connectedness. And naturalists and supernaturalists differ in the explanation of why we're connected. A supernaturalist would say we're all connected because we're all made in the image of God. We're all siblings of the same divine parents, so to speak. Naturalists still believe we're all connected to one another. They just simply disagree with supernaturalists as to why we are connected. But again, they agree with each other that we are all connected. And in many naturalists, that discovery has deepened their compassion and empowered them with the tools to make a difference in others' lives. And finally, some Christians warn that if the naturalistic worldview is embraced, it'll produce a world devoid of ethics. And I have yet to meet an amoral naturalist. Their ethics may have a different basis than an apocalypticist, but I think it's unfair to say that naturalism ultimately removes all of our ethics. Let's talk about Jesus for a moment and Jesus followers and naturalism. Although the writers of the early Jesus story were not naturalists, the Jesus that we find in the story offered a wisdom teaching that I believe can be relevant even for contemporary naturalists today when we look at the teachings of Jesus. And notice what is said in our feature text this week in Matthew 28, 17 through 19. And again, it's from the Message version or the Message paraphrase. Jesus invited his disciples to produce other Jesus followers. And a Jesus follower is not someone who has embraced the worldview of first century people who first heard Jesus speak. What it meant to be a Jesus follower back then was to be trained in a way of life, in the practice of the ethics and values of the first century Jewish revolutionary Jesus. And many in that era embraced a Jewish apocalyptic worldview, and yet they were not followers of Jesus. So the point is, the worldview and discipleship, they're not the same thing. The question we have to wrestle with today is whether someone must embrace a first century Jewish apocalyptic worldview to follow Jesus in the 21st century. And I don't believe they have to. The Jesus of the Jesus story offered an alternative wisdom to the social norms of his own day. He valued every human being as a being of inestimable worth. And so he contrasted with the way the culture used the purity codes to marginalize some of those people. He taught within his own context, and his teachings had a political dimension. Jesus opposed arranging human society according to domination systems. He challenged the Roman domination system and its religious legitimization in the Jewish temple at that time, especially among the priests and some of the Jewish leaders. And we could gain much from paying attention to the religious legitimization of political domination in our own time and culture. And you can contrast some of those. But if you'd like to pursue that a little bit further, I want to recommend a great book for you that I just finished. It's a book called The Last Week, What the Gospels Really Teach About Jesus' Final Days in Jerusalem by Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan, or Dom Crossan, as he's fond of being referred to. But in addition, Jesus taught nonviolent non-cooperation and nonviolent confrontation in response to unjust domination systems. And this nonviolence can be tested. It can be observed. We're talking about the scientific method. It can be observed and seen to have tangible and repeatable results in the lives of those such as Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Jesus' teachings also had an economic dimension. They called to account systems that produce poverty. He offered a preferential option for the poor in our societies. And his stories, like the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son, called his audience to look at themselves and to look at everyone else around them and a radically different way. So Jesus made original contributions for his own place and time within Jewish culture, and he was offering offering a transformative and restorative justice for everyone, for all, based on a universal, non-discriminatory love for all. And as we said last week, since the 4th century, Christianity has transitioned away from earth and began focusing on how people might enter a post-mortem heaven. But this focus wasn't the focus of the early Jesus community. Jesus offered the people teachings on matters that were directly related to this world, not another world. And although the Jesus in the story spoke of supernatural entities, his teachings primarily offer a set of values and ethics that we can test to discern whether they will help us find the way to a safer, more compassionate world for us all. That's why Jesus's movement, the original Jesus movement, was not called Christianity. Originally, they referred to it as the way. And as Jesus taught, we can know by their fruit whether these ethics and values and teachings have value. A naturalistic worldview is common in our time, and it may remodel our cosmology, it may adjust our understanding of history, yet I don't believe that it requires us to remove our sense of a heart at the center of the universe or relegate first century Jesus to irrelevance. Science and Jesus can be good neighbors to each other. And again, there's not one Jesus follower I know today who subscribes to a purely apocalyptic or a purely naturalistic worldview. We subscribe to a hybrid of both, and I believe there's room in the human family for us all. As we learn to listen to each other, even with our differences, we are going to together, we'll find a way to Jesus, a safer, more compassionate world. And those of you who are further down the naturalist spectrum than me, and you may be curious to see ways that other naturalists embrace Jesus, check out four articles. I want to list them in the e-site. You can go to the renewedheartministries.com, go to this week's e-site on Jesus and Naturalism, and look up these four articles. The first one is Naturalistic Christianity 101. The second one is Christian Naturalism. The third is A Christian Naturalism, Developing the Thinking of Gordon Kaufman. And the last one is Christianity Without Religion. And all four of those articles, again, you'll find links to where you can read those in our e-site this week. And I'll close this week with a statement by Arthur G. Broadhurst, who is a Christian naturalist himself. Once we get beyond the mythological language in the Gospels, it is clear that the disciples had a life-transforming experience that resulted in a reordering of their priorities towards a new way of thinking, and it led to their commitment to carry on Jesus's teachings. Being a Christian does not require a simultaneous belief in gods or theological propositions, in magic or superstitions. Anyone who claims to be a follower of Jesus should be seen standing with the weak against the powerful and the rich, feeding the hungry, comforting the sick, bandaging the wounded, holding the hand of the child, standing with the oppressed against the oppressor. It means humility rather than arrogance and pride, and it means becoming fully human. Heart group application this week. This week we're learning to listen to those who may see things differently than we do. And heart groups are intended to help us experience what Jesus modeled at his own shared table. This is a quotation that I'm fond of. Some people live closely guarded lives, fearful of encountering someone or something that might shatter their insecure spiritual foundation. This attitude, however, is not the fault of religion, but their own limited understanding. And the beauty of Jesus' shared table is that it enables us to begin integrating various and diverse perspectives into a meaningful and consistent whole. Each of us, at the same time, we're discovering our own blind spots, and as this happens, as we're choosing to listen to one another. And Jesus is calling us to choose love for one another over and against fear of one another. So number one, this week, take Matthew 5 through 7 and list the teachings of Jesus there that you find meaningful and maybe even challenging for you a little bit personally. And then number two, list the teachings that you have questions about, that you don't really understand. And then number three, present both lists to your heart group this week and invite anyone who's willing to share from their own perspective what the teachings in your second list that you had questions about may mean. And I've witnessed some amazingly beautiful moments that emerge from members of a diverse group following these three simple steps. And the purpose is not for everyone to see everything the same. These are moments for us, again, to practice listening. Difference is inevitable, but division is optional. Till the only world that remains is Jesus' safe and compassionate world where love reigns. I love each one of you. I'll see you next week. Thank you once again for listening to this podcast. As I said earlier, Renewed Heart Ministries is a not-for-profit organization that is dedicated to helping people explore and understand the teachings of Jesus. Everything we do here is for free. We don't make any money off of our seminars that we do in various local venues, and all of our resources are provided for free online. I have a hard time philosophically charging people money for that which I think Jesus gave to humanity for free. And so we take Jesus' words very seriously. Freely you've received, freely give. Even anything that we receive above our annual budget, we don't keep. We like to pass that on to other charities who are making a difference with the poor in this world. So if you'd like to support Renewed Heart Ministries and the work that we're doing in helping others encounter Jesus, please go to renewedheartministries.com. You can either you can go to renewedheartministries.com/donate, or if you go to just the website, you can click in the upper right the link there that says donate. You can make a one-time gift or become one of our monthly contributors. Every little bit helps. And for those of you who are already supporting us, with all of our hearts, we want to take this opportunity to say thank you. You're the one that's enabling us to share Jesus far and wide all around the globe. Thank you to each one of you for listening once again. As we like to say here at Renewed Heart Ministries, till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Thank each one of you so much.